Welcome to ID the Future. This is a podcast at the Center for Science and Culture. I'm Robert Crowther, and with me today is Discovery Institute Senior Fellow Michael Keyes. Michael has a PhD in History of Science, and he is an adjunct professor of History and Philosophy of Science at Biola University. He also has a pretty extensive background in helping teachers by writing and developing curriculum. He creates and develops teaching materials and leads workshops for teachers on how to teach controversial topics, which is something that we have a little familiarity with here at the Center for Science and Culture. So we'll talk about that a little bit today. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Glad I could join you, Rob.
Yes, I'm glad you're here. As you know, and as the listeners know, we do deal, obviously, with something that's got a bit of controversy around it, with the debate over intelligent design theory and modern evolutionary theory and how to teach or approach those two areas. And you have, as I mentioned, a lot of experience in that. How long have you been teaching on that and training other teachers for dealing with controversial subjects?
I have taught in the sciences and history of science for about a quarter century. And there have been several times during that period that I've also developed and delivered some workshops for science teachers to help them to learn from the things that I've learned by my own teaching experience, plus, of course, reading what many other teachers have found effective, particularly those that apply the history and philosophy of science to effective science teaching, which is what my specialty is.
Okay. So given your specialty in that and you're being a history of science expert, down through the years, there have been a lot of controversies in science, and today is no different. I mean, we have obviously a lot of controversy if you watch the news over how to teach science, how to do science, how to pay for science, what constitutes science, all those things. There must have been times during the history of civilization that there were other controversies like this. What can we learn from those, or how could we apply those lessons to today?
Well, we can learn that science is a publicly contestable area of dialogue and that it's okay to have differences of opinion. You just need to be able to back those up with evidence and argument. So through the years, scientists have proposed different explanations for natural phenomena, that is, theories or hypotheses, and tested them and come up with explanations or proposed explanations of the world. And so over time, there is a winnowing process by which the explanations that best make sense of the world tend to surface through review of others who have that specialty, so that eventually the best theories surface in many disciplines. Now, some disciplines have had longer term controversies where things weren't so nicely and neatly resolved. So you'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis to see when and where consensus might be achieved.
Okay. Give us a case like that, a time in history or a controversy that was a big deal, and then how did scientists either come to consensus or put that to rest?
Sure. I'll pick a topic that is one that most students learn in their middle school years, and then typically gets reviewed in high school as well, and that is continental drift, or as it's now known, plate tectonics.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's this German scientist by the name of Alfred Wegener who noticed that continents like South America and Africa seem to fit well together if you were to mentally sort of scoot them together, where one continent has a protrusion, the other has an indentation. They seem to sort of fit together like puzzle pieces. Well, one way to explain this, as Wegener proposed, would be to say that perhaps these continents have drifted over time, probably slowly, since we don't sense any definite movement in our own lifetimes, and that over long periods of time, the continents achieve their current positions and orientations relative to each other. So at first, this seemed like a crazy idea because the number one objection that many raise was, okay, Wegener, nice idea, but what's your causal story? what mechanism would enable huge continents that weigh massive amounts of weight to move or scoot across the Earth? Well, Wegener, early on when he was making this case in the early 20th century, he realized that the lack of a causal mechanism was a problem, but he considered it really premature. First, he thought that he had a strong circumstantial case for the continents drifting, and he thought that eventually we might come up with an adequate mechanism to account for its happening. And of course, he turned out to be right, but there were many decades that passed where this minority position in science, some considered it not even legitimate science, but eventually good science will surface through multiple research groups working on it, and eventually the evidence may or may not surface depending on what's actually true. And in this case, the controversy was resolved in the middle of the 20th century by means of other discoveries, such as the convection currents under the surface of the Earth. Kind of like when you boil water, there's convection currents, and that's one of the mechanisms that helps explain the movement of continents.
Oh.
So eventually it got resolved.
Interesting. Did Wegener live long enough to see the resolution himself?
No, and that would be a good lesson for those who happen to hold minority positions in science for which there's good evidence, but it's just not popular for other reasons. Or maybe the evidence is strong in some areas, but weak in other areas. Like in this example, the circumstantial evidence was pretty strong, but it lacked causal adequacy. That is, an adequate causal mechanism for it. So when you have multiple competing hypotheses, you want to figure out which one is the best or able to explain the most categories of facts. And in this case, Wegener's theory was strong in one area, but weak in another. And he was aware of that and even talked about it. But it was later generations that finally was able to resolve this.
But at the same time, people are studying it, researching it, learning about it. And so teachers and scientists have to be able to grapple with that issue and present it, even though it may not be fully resolved. And there's an obvious connection here to the Center for Science and Culture, is we are knee-deep in a scientific controversy, namely the debate between design and modern evolutionary theory, and those things are being currently taught. So I'm wondering, when you are helping teachers, what sort of advice do you have for them, for high school and college science teachers that have to present certainly the kind of standard modern evolutionary theory, but maybe questions come up about other things as well?
I often like to say that science is best taught as it is best practiced. And science is best practiced in an open dialogue of competing ideas. There shouldn't be viewpoint discrimination. If there's a minority viewpoint that has at least some evidence going for it, it ought to be heard and evaluated. And so, like in the case I gave of continental drift, I kind of gave you the beginning and end of the story. There's a middle part of the story that connects with the question you just asked that would be of use for science teachers, and that is, before there were adequate causal stories of how the continents could move, the circumstantial case for it actually was significantly strengthened through, for example, the study of the magnetic sort of fingerprint of different parts of the sea floor built a much stronger case than Wegener had available to him for continental drift. And so it actually, in this case, continental drift was accepted by the majority of Earth scientists in the late 1960s based on this stronger evidential case, despite the continuing lack of an adequate cause for it. So I think that the lesson for science teachers is, don't just use one measure in trying to infer the best explanation, but take into account multiple kinds of criteria. Causal adequacy is one, but there are many others, such as evidential accuracy, and then also one that really requires the history of science to track, and that is, what is the track record of a theory over time? Does it seem to solve more problems, or does it seem to be backed up into a corner where it kind of has to come up with excuses or ad hoc hypotheses to sort of patch itself up and resist refutation? Is it in that sort of defensive mode, or is it in more of a positive mode of progressively explaining more things? And that was the case with continental drift, even before an adequate cause was finally found after the 1960s.
Yeah. I should mention here that as we talk about different theories like this, Discovery Institute's position on science education policy for public schools, anyhow, is not to mandate or introduce intelligent design in the curriculum, but rather to teach both the strengths and weaknesses of Darwinian evolution, so the science that supports it and some of the things that challenge it, because otherwise people may misconstrue what we're talking about doing. But I think that that points out a good thing, that when you have a controversy, it's hard to address the issue sometimes fully. And it seems like this would be an area where you could give some good advice for college, or maybe even more for high school teachers, in how to approach that when these questions come up.
Yeah, I think so, that teachers need to not only be reading the textbooks that are used in the classrooms, but also do some background reading that will give them more depth and wisdom in how to best make sense of the required curriculum. They want to not only teach students the conclusions of science, but they want to teach them the process, how science over time works through issues. And both are extremely important. And so I think science is best taught as its best practice, as I mentioned earlier. There are some practical limitations or restrictions in the science classroom, but overall, that is something that my field of history of science and the sister discipline of philosophy of science help science teachers with. And in fact, a number of statements and handbooks on teaching science from the National Academy of Sciences and the American Association for the Advancement of Science have said just that sort of thing, that history and philosophy of science are important to give more depth to the teaching of science. Let me just add one footnote, and that is teachers don't have time to cover lots of history and philosophy of science material, so there are certain practical restrictions. So you can't do this with every single subject you teach, but I think if they fail to do it, at least in some areas, then they've done their students a great disservice. So I just advocate balance in both covering the process of science as well as the content of science, because the teachers have certain practical restrictions in what they can do.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today on the podcast and sharing your insights, and let people know, for those of you interested in keeping up with the latest news on the debate over teaching of evolution, I would recommend regular visits to Evolution News in Science Today, where Michael is a contributor, along with a number of other scientists and scholars. Evolution News in Science Today is online at evolutionnews.org. That is evolutionnews.org. Thanks again, Michael, for being with us.
All right, Rob. Thanks for the conversation. I enjoyed it.
Yes, thank you for being here. For ID the Future, I'm Robert Crowther. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.